Music and Booze with Mo is produced and distributed by Eats Drinks TV, a service of the Center for Culinary Culture, home of the Cocktail Collection, and First Reel Entertainment, and is available wherever fine podcasts can be heard. The Center for Culinary Culture, telling the story of food and drink, one taste at a time. Welcome to Music and Booze with Mo. I'm Mo Herms, and I've worked in the music industry most of my life, so have met some pretty amazing musicians over the years. I also love a good cocktail, and I've encountered some really interesting bartenders as well. It seems that there is a lot of crossover, so when I can, I like to talk to musicians and bartenders about music and booze. Join us at the bar, won't you? Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by Barkeeper, a head shop for cocktail lovers, located at 614 North Hoover Street in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Stop by for barware, vintage glassware, a carefully curated collection of spirits, and one of the most impressive selections of bitters anywhere. Follow them on Instagram and Facebook for information regarding spirits tastings. That's barkeepersilverlake.com. And also in the Virgil Village neighborhood of Silver Lake, Los Angeles.
I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees.
Chris Hanna is many things. Award-winning bartender, award-winning bar owner, bar and restaurant owner. These are the things that you see splashed in the trades when you hear about Chris Hanna. But did you know that Chris Hanna is also a very, very intensely avid blues fan? In fact, when I met him, before I met him, I was told, oh, you've got to ask him about juke joints. He knows all about juke joints. And I got to sit down and have one of the loveliest conversations I've had the opportunity to have. I learned so much from this amazingly dapper gentleman who came to New Orleans knowing what he wanted to do. He wanted to go somewhere where he could learn how to make classic cocktails, but also keep things somewhat modern, where he could dress the way he wanted to dress, where he could sit on the river and smoke a cigar, and where he could take road trips up and down the Mississippi to check out all of the juke joints along the way. Really amazing person, fascinating talk, and you are in for a treat. Chris Hanna of Jewel of the South in New Orleans, and so much more, is our guest today. So sit back and relax and learn. Learn a whole lot.
I always bike to work anyway.
What do you go out to the Delta for? Is that a music thing?
Yeah, it's always blues and just like to be alone.
And to be alone?
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I think when I had talked to Anine for a moment and told her that I was going to get to talk to you, and she goes, oh, he knows all the juke joints. I was like, what?
Yeah, finding more juke joints was just like the last bit of, you know, Black American Southern history that I just wanted to make sure I witnessed before it was gone. And it's like the most fascinating thing about the South for me is the juke. I mean, because you know, everybody thinks that New Orleans jazz is like the nice, pretty, quiet, sit down and pay attention, sweet jazz, like, you know, Coltrane and, you know, and all that. But when you actually get down here, you realize that the jazz is the blues. It's just more instruments. Because it's all song. None of it's, I mean, Jelly Roll Morton had obviously had a lot of, probably the most songs, and he's playing the piano, so it's like, that's all, you know, pretty much not with lyrics and everything, but all of New Orleans music is blues, and the history of that going all the way up to Chicago, and that whole drive through the Delta is the same, you know, trip for all the musicians in Louisiana going north. Yeah. And so it's still alive in the Delta. And just a nice break after like going through an entire season. I usually go twice a year, always, and it's just a nice relieving situation. I'll sit there, it's like I go to the Shack Up Inn. I have, like, as soon as you check in the Shack Up Inn, they give you a guitar as well.
Which is, really?
It's so funny, because obviously I don't play the guitar. But
I know I own a guitar, but that doesn't mean I can play it.
Yeah, but I still always take it up there, and it's a rocking chair. It's like my own shack porch. I'll make a mint julep, and I just sit there, and I'm just happy to be there. And then I roll in and go to Reds or Ground Zero. That's kind of my ritual to get out of New Orleans.
So when you say when the season ends, is that Mardi Gras season, or there's so many seasons here in New Orleans?
Yeah, I mean, no, the season's really.
Because I don't see seasons. I mean, I'm from California. We don't really have seasons out there. Mm. It's wet sometimes, maybe if we're lucky.
Right.
Otherwise, it's just kind of hot.
No, mostly it's always the convention season, and then the first bit of convention season in the fall. So I will go in June, because that's what, usually, I mean, our season is January to the end of May.
Okay.
So all the conventions, they start as soon as Mardi Gras is over. So the week after Mardi Gras, the city is completely full again, but there's just no parades. It's just full of convention goers, and they were just busy, and it's just straight through, you know, because you got French Quarter Fest, Jazz Fest is two weekends, and then May is just like the last bit of big conventions, and then the really big college graduations, and so like it just goes from January until June, and that's when I want to get out of here, you know.
And when you get out of here, you try to just go on your own and check out music.
It's the drive itself.
Yeah.
Is a ritual. I found all three Robert Johnson graves. I go and
three Robert Johnson graves?
Yeah. Robert, he has three graves.
I didn't know that.
And it's still hard for me to find one of them. Because it's the street, when you're on these numbered roads, you're on a two lane each way, small country road, going through the Delta. After Bentonia, which is where I go to see Jimmy Duck Holmes' Blue Front, which is the first juke joint ever. But then you're going to Greenwood, and there's no signs, so you have to make sure that you're used to this, like, oh, there's this silo or whatever, you know, this corn and these old tractors that are there. And then you make the left, you find the church, and then there's a Robert Johnson grave, and people know where it is because every time you go,
there's
guitar picks. Yeah. I always pour a little bit of old Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
I pour him a little bit and I take a small sip. And then I think this, the Rolling Stones made another one because they were trying to listen to his biography, you know.
So the Rolling Stones made a grave?
I think it's the Rolling Stones.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they made a grave for him.
They agreed with other people who were with the historians of Robert Johnson, saying that the crossroads.
Yeah. The legendary
that is
crossroads
in Clarksdale, which is awesome to see, couldn't have been where it was, and so they just decided to find their own crossroads that was close to the stream or river that he was talking about, and they made another one because they believed that's where the people buried him. While the church, that initial church, says that that's where he's buried, and then there's stones there. So there's one there. You keep going for miles, and there's the other one. You get up in the road, and you see where the people believe is where he died, and where they believe that he just he was buried, because he was poisoned.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to Greenwood, and you go to the Mount Zion one, where it has the bigger monument, and that's where most people believe he actually is, because that's where the people actually say they went to his funeral. Say that that's where they went. And so there's old records there. There's guitar picks. And so I pour a little old bits at the Rolling Stone one, and then I pour a little old bits at the other one, and then I finally get to Clarksdale and I get my shack, and it's just awesome.
I had no idea that he had a controversial burial place.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't. I mean,
when I found that out, I had to find all of them. I mean, I had to find all of them. And I did it before. It was so, I mean, like, well before there was iPhones.
Yeah.
You know, we had cell phones, but we didn't have the iPhones. And so I was, like, searching, and it took so long.
Well, even so, I mean, I was thinking about the first time I came to New Orleans, and I stayed in a hostel in the Garden District, right? And that was, like, 91, maybe? And I was thinking about that place and wondering where it was, and I jumped online. I'm all, okay, Garden District Hostel. Like, I know it's not this place. I know it's not this place. And I just thought, well, then, in 91, how did I find that place? I found, like, a Lonely Planet or a photo's guide or something like that where people had listed that information and, like, called ahead and made the reservation. And, you know, before we had our computers in our pockets and things like that, you know, just
Printed it out.
Yeah.
That's what I did when I came to New Orleans.
Pulled out your Thomas Brothers maps.
That's what I did when I came to New Orleans was I printed out slate.com, had a blues travel guide, and I was just like, I'm doing that guide. But I did it the other way around, because what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to start in New Orleans. You go to Natchez, you go to Greenwood, you go to Clarksdale, you go to Memphis, and then you go to Chicago. And I think Louisville, maybe Louisville, I don't know, but after Memphis, but because I wasn't going to Chicago, I was coming from Baltimore, I went straight to Memphis, and I did the entire blues guide, and that's where I found out about Juke Joints, Social Aid and Pleasure Club, and the one that I'm really happy I actually got to go to was Wild Bill's in Memphis. And then he passed away in 07, so I got to see him, and I took a photo with him, and I would just, it was the most amazing Southern Social Aid and Pleasure Black experience that I've had. I went to Gus's Chicken, and the guy was just like, you're going down to New Orleans, and you seem like you kind of want to do some cool things. And it was really strange. He was like, do you mind being around Black people? I'm like, obviously not many people know my dad's Black, my mom's white. But I thought it was strange, but I was just like, yeah, of course. And he was like, you've got to go to Wild Bill's. You're here on a Sunday. It's a special day. And I went there, and all these people just walk up on stage with horns and guitars, and they were playing the amazing live blues, and all you could drink were 40s and Miller Lite. And it was all these stolen hotel cups were passing around, because you know the one with the little, like, ripple around the end?
Yeah.
That were in, like, old school Howard Johnson's and everything, and Radisson's or whatever. Those are the only cups they had. Wild Bill's, that was, like, my first experience.
Just high life.
That was amazing. And then I did the rest of the trail. Went to Greenwood, went to Natchez, and then got to New Orleans, and then, you know, learn more about the Juke Joints, and then twice a year I go up. You know, Paul Monkey, he passed away maybe 6 years ago, and that was my favorite one to go to. Yeah.
When did you get so interested in Juke Joints and blues and all that kind of stuff? That's not something a little kid picks up usually.
Yeah, you're right. Luckily, like, my parents were old souls, and so I was raised to be one. And I just really appreciated anything that looked old and was old. And so my parents moved us to the East Coast, because we were in the Navy, so we're really not. We moved every 3 years. We lived out of the country twice. But we got to the East Coast, and I got to see, I witnessed Virginia Beach, D.C., and Baltimore all mimicking what I think in my mind looks like Boston, and it's like everyday USA, because at the time is when all the big box stores had everything you could buy to make it cheaper, so everything looked the same. Nothing was unique anymore.
Yeah.
And I've been to New Orleans a couple of times, and I was just like, man, that place, like, all the houses, even if it's not in the French Quarter, the houses are unique, you know? Mm-hmm. And I got more into jazz, more into the blues, and I was just like really getting, you know, I wasn't okay with everyday USA America. I didn't really care about any of the music coming out. I wanted to lose myself and just go back in time, bartend at an old place, wear a bow tie and cufflinks, and just, you know, look like the people that were my heroes, like, you know, Louis Armstrong. It's like you always expect to see him in a suit.
Because
that's where all of his main photos, but if you saw the way he dressed when he wasn't, like, on stage, you know, collars over collars, the 70s, so hip, you know? And then I get down here, and I just found more heroes, like Danny Barker, James Booker, Professor Longhair, Dr. John, and it's like everybody dressed so freaking cool.
And when you say everyone, you mean the musicians?
The musicians. And so I would just like, I'm gonna look like my heroes from down here. It's like, I'm not going to care about Everyday USA. I'm not wearing your clothes. I'm not listening to your soundtrack. I'm not looking at your backdrop. I'm on my own play, which is what I associate New Orleans is. It's its own play. We have our own backdrop. We have our own soundtrack. And what's really kind of pretty about and beautiful about this city is it's so small, we actually get to be the characters. So I get to bike to work, 15 years, put on a white tuxedo jacket, and 10 Bar, one of the prettiest bars in the whole city, the French 75 Bar. Mm-hmm. You know? So,
what was the first bar that you, when did you start bartending?
I bartended 6 years before, almost 7 years before moving to New Orleans. So I was at a college bar. I was at a fun beer bar that was like rowdy and, mm-hmm. you know, and crazy, like in college.
But yeah. And were you in college at that time too? So it was So it's kind of perfect while you get your training wheels set.
But exactly. But it was strange because I also worked at a restaurant that was a New Orleans bistro. And then I got to see more, like, the prettier things I didn't really get to witness because my parents didn't drink anyway, so we never went to restaurants like that. So working in a nice restaurant and then seeing, like, the cuisine, the way people dined, and then, like, having cocktails before and then, like DJ Steve's after was, like, a new, you know, that was a new way of, a new lifestyle of dining and drinking and being responsible and actually having a class about it. So then I left the college bar scene, and I was the only one my age, one of the work in a place where I made martinis, and my clientele switched from like the 20s to they were all 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
You know, teaching me like the Gibson, the Gimlet. And so I worked at a nice place in Baltimore, the Charleston, which is awesome. You know, Cindy Wolf is an amazing chef, you know, and just watching, you know, the high level of being a you know, in the kitchen and a server, and it's just like witnessing the servers like truly care about learning the wines, pair with the food. It's like the first time I ever had sweetbreads, first time I ever had like pate and, you know, dessert wine. So I got into like high level bartending because I wanted to make nice cocktails for a restaurant like that. And so then I came down to New Orleans, but I still didn't know the Sazerac. You know, I never heard of the Sazerac, the Milk Punch, the Pimp's Cup, because like in the 90s, nobody was making that. We were lucky to make Gibsons and Gimlets.
I was going to say, so this is in the 90s and you're wanting to learn the nice old-fashioned cocktails.
Yeah.
But it goes with your aesthetic for sure.
Yeah.
To want to know those things. So when you came here in the 90s then?
No. I finally got here in 03.
So that was still early in that resurgence.
Right.
You know.
I came here in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
But I wasn't able to move.
Got it.
Until I really realized and I witnessed like the architecture, like I was saying, and everything looking the same, and I just knew that I couldn't do it anymore. So I just I just left.
I mean, I live in California, so I completely understand that. It's, you know, I live in Los Angeles, which is a city renowned for tearing down its history. You know, they've gotten a lot better in the last 20 years, but, and, you know, also, I grew up in San Diego, and I lived in the Bay Area for a long time. So there are old buildings around, but over there, when you find an old building, if it's as old as so many buildings here in New Orleans, it's like a California mission, you know, because that was built before California was part of the United States.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's like, this is from the 20s. Oh, my gosh. You know, there might be some 1800s here and there, but most of those fell in earthquakes or something. But coming out here, I can walk all over the place in this. Every house is interesting.
Yeah.
The shutters, the way things are built, the reason they were built certain ways, you can just tell in the structure. Well, this is a carriage house. You can tell that that's where the carriages used to go. And you know these shutters are for this purpose. And everyone's got a porch. You know, everyone's got a balcony. It's so wonderful. I love walking around looking at it. So I understand that.
Yeah, my house is 1906. And Jewel is 1830s. Arnaud's was 1918 when that opened. It was the buildings are from the 1800s, but I mean Arnaud's opened in 1918, so that's, you know, 105 now. So coming down here was just like, it took me like 5 years to just be like, say to myself, it's over, you know. You're not. I'm not from anywhere. I'm not from like. I mean, Baltimore is great, but it's just not where I was going to end up. So
you could choose your own home, really.
Yeah.
You had so many different places to live while you were growing up.
Yeah. Choose my own home. Choose like where I was going to work, how I was going to dress, like which city I was going to represent, and you know.
And New Orleans was it.
Yeah, New Orleans was it.
So where did you?
And all I see for misery, I got a right to sing the blues. I got a right to moan and sigh. I got a right to sit and cry. Down around the river.
So where did you, what bar did you wind up at when you first came here?
Yeah, French 25.
Was the first
As soon
bar.
As I landed, yeah, I had 3 days.
Wow.
So my first day I got here, I put everything in my house. Walked around and applied everywhere. And the second day, I unpacked everything. I got a couple calls, and then I went and I came and did the interviews. And it was so funny because I got the interview to like Brennan's, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I love. Brennan's are awesome.
Yeah.
But when I got the interview with Brennan's, this is so proper, and this is what I like about him.
Yeah.
Like, you apply to be a bartender, you need to be able to put the write the ingredients for these drinks. And like I said, you know, in the 90s, in the very first 2 or 3 years of the 2000s, zero places were making Sazerac,
yeah.
Bucaray, Pim's Cup, Milk Punch, Ramos Gin Fizz. And I was just like, I've been bartending at a high level for almost 7 years.
So,
I've never heard, I was just like, oh my gosh. And so
I need to start all over.
Dickie Brennan Steakhouse said I'm sorry. Brennan said I'm sorry. Antoine's was just like, and Antoine's didn't have a bar anyway, so that was okay. But Arnaud's was, I got a call, and they were like, we like your experience. We can tell that you can actually be behind the bar, and we're lacking right now with somebody who's has like speed with making cocktails. And I was like, well, I really appreciate the call, but I gotta be honest with you, I don't know what a Sazerac is. I don't know what a milk punch is. I got denied by Brennan's. They were like, doesn't matter, we're gonna train you. You already have bartending experience. All you have to do is just train for a couple weeks, learn these recipes. And I was just like, all right. And so then the third day, I started.
Wow.
So I had 2 days off when I landed. I started the third day.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Because it's a legendary spot. Legendary spot. And then you kind of contributed to it because you stayed there for like, what, the next 15 years or something?
Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
So then people get to know you. And wow, that's a really amazing to think that became almost like, what, finishing school in a sense?
Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah, it was just too beautiful. The bar was just too beautiful. So when I
love that space. I go there as often as I can.
Yeah.
Town.
There wasn't a bar program yet. I developed it. My whole thing was I knew what was going on in New York. And I knew that cocktails were coming back. Because I was working at a good bar in Baltimore, but still weren't making any New Orleans drinks. But I knew that there's something going on. And what my whole thing was, I didn't want Arnaud's in the French 25 bar to rest on its laurels and just only make the old drinks, because I knew the cocktail craze was starting. And in the next 2 years, it did. And I knew, and like there was no Tonique then, there was no Cure, you know. So 75 was the first, you know. And I'm really good friends with Neil, so we knew that we were going to start a cocktail revolution. So he opened Bar Tonique, and then he opened Cure, and I stayed at 75 Bar. And my whole mission was for people to come to New Orleans and still see an old bar that are making the drinks the exact same way and as good as all the Brooklyn bars that were, and all the San Francisco bars. Because those are the number one in two cities.
Yeah, it was all Bourbon and Branch and PDT, right?
Well, even before PDT, when this is when he, me and everybody from Death & Co. came from Pegu Club. I mean, Pegu Club spawned everybody.
Yeah.
You know, PDT, Death & Co., I mean, everyone. So San Francisco, New York started this in the very beginning. Boston is a really close second, to be honest. And then Chicago. And we were right with Chicago joining in, but obviously we were smaller, you know. But it was my job, because I moved down here, because I'm an old soul, because I wanted old things to last. It was my job to make one of these old places stay at the same level as everyone else. And that's why I stayed there for 15 years. Like, the owners thought I was going to leave each time. Like, when Cure opened, they're like, you're going to go work at Cure. And guests were just like, you're definitely going to be going to Cure. It's like, no, this is, I'm going to make sure this is always going to be a place. You know, and then, I mean, that's the first bar Christoph ever worked in. So I trained Christoph, and so I'm glad he's still, you know, keeping 75. And 75 is always going to be what it is now, because it's just like, there's no going back.
No, it's absolutely true, because people know. I mean, I bring friends there, and I'm like, you can get the classics perfectly done here, and you can get some amazing new ones, you know?
Yeah.
And Christoph has his little tiki bents, so
things
like that on the menu, but people love that, you know? Yeah. They love trying something new, but also having the old comfort drinks, you know, there as well. It's like your comfort food, your comfort cocktails, just as important, I think. So I love that space very much. But then you left, and...
Yeah, I didn't think I was going to leave.
When you finally did leave. Was it Jewel, or was it Manolito, or a little bit of everything?
We opened Manolito while I was still at 75. Because I'm a small partner in Manolito. We all opened it together because of our trips to Cuba, which were amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we brought back our love affair with the Cuban bar style to offer our city.
When you were in Cuba, did you actually train a little bit as well?
Yeah,
you get to get behind the bar?
Every single time I've ever been, because we went with Julio Cabrera, and it was his mission to finally bring New Orleans bartenders who loved Cuban history and cocktail history to Cuba. And so I was on the first trip. I've been on 7 trips. I think I've been on the most. So, I mean, just meeting these people, it's like they love meeting a New Orleans bartender. So when we go, we always coincided our trips to when there was a Cuban bartending function.
Oh,
so
cool.
We could meet the bartenders, go to their events and watch their competitions. Because the Cuban bartending association is the oldest in the whole world.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So Cuba has the oldest. Okay. Japan and England are next, and then Italy.
Wow.
So Cuba has always had a cocktail history, culture.
Yeah.
Never died.
No one ever got in the way of it.
right. Yeah, that's true. But when we went, it was so special because they were just so happy to see the American bartenders coming over. And so they know us so well. It's like, I mean, it's just amazing to walk in there and they're all like, Hannah. You know, it's just like I'm going to another world when you go to Cuba. These people like know me, you know, it's so awesome. And it's really special too because they don't get like the new pretty tools and stuff. So we go.
Their ingenuity is, I've been to Cuba once. I only was in Havana while I was there. And I was just, I guess they say that necessity is the mother of invention, right? So just seeing what they can do with what they have is very humbling.
Right.
You know, and it just shows me how privileged I am. Even more than I already thought I was. But yeah, the people were just so welcoming, friendly, and I remember being there and one meeting some bartenders while I was there, and I remember that one of them said to me, you know, we don't have a problem with you because people are not their government.
Right.
And you recognize that.
Yeah.
I'm like, thank you for that. Yeah. But I went with a little group of friends. We were able to do a cultural exchange over there. It was 2015, and where I was staying, right behind me was a little cafe that had a small bar in the back. And the guy that was working the bar, his name was Marlon, because I remember I went back there and everyone else was sleeping, and he offered me some rum, because I'm like, I need to know what rum I'm going to try to bring back with me. And he's like, just stay here, I'll serve you up some rum. So he gave me some rum, and then his boss, who I swear was named Axel, came out and was offering me cigars, and they're like, okay, here's how you smoke the cigar as you sip the rum. And it turned out that these two, Marlon had competed in an event in Santiago.
Mm-hmm.
and he had done part of the opening menu for Sloppy Joe's when they reopened.
That's
or
awesome.
Something. And it was really neat to get to meet him and talk with him about that. He and his sister both would compete around the island.
Yeah.
And they were just so enthusiastic and so into teaching and showing, and they loved that I appreciated it and was so appreciative of the bartending culture there. And I think they were just really proud, and I was happy to...
When did you go?
It was in 2015.
Yeah, we went to Sloppy Joe the year it opened. So I know that I've met Marlon, and also they when they compete, they are really proud.
Oh, yeah.
It is awesome.
Oh, yeah. I feel like Sloppy Joe's hadn't been open too long
when
I got there.
And, yeah, you're right.
So I told him he's like, are you going to Sloppy Joe's? I'm like, of course I am. I know it's revamped and all, but it's still a legendary spot. And he's like, oh, I came up with not all the menu. I think he did like half of the menu. He said, there'll be a picture of me in there somewhere. And they're in the columns where they have the photographs.
Yeah, yeah.
I found him and I told him later, hey, I saw you there.
Yeah, I'm so bummed that I wasn't on a trip where we all made drinks behind the Sloppy Joe.
Oh, wow.
And I have a photo at Jewel right now. I'll show it. We were all behind the bar at Sloppy Joe. So I made a Sloppy Joe at Sloppy Joe's. It was super great.
Oh, that's so cool.
But yeah, we were there. Like, we went there in 13. It wasn't open yet. We could look in. It was under construction. So you're right. I think it opened like either the end of 14 or the beginning.
Maybe 15. Yeah, it was October of 15 when I was there.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It was very cool to get to go there. And I think... I went every day. I was only there for a week.
And every day
I went and talked with Marlon in this little cafe in the back.
The sister is the one who was running.
I mean
the night we went.
Maybe she did. Because I know he told me that he did the competitions with his sister. Mm-hmm. And that she was just as good. I remember him saying that. And
so
he would never say that she was better than him, you know?
Right, yeah.
He's too busy trying to flirt with the American this whole time. But it was wonderful. They were so great and so proud and so good at what they did. I loved it. So
yeah,
you guys were going there, and you decided, you were like, we're bringing this back.
Yeah.
We're going to do this in New Orleans.
Yeah, you know, Conrad already had El Libre, but Nick wanted to, like, build a small bar that fit in and actually turn it into more of an actual bar and restaurant. Mm-hmm. So we knocked down the booths upstairs, put in, I think, 5 tables, mm-hmm. and then that bar downstairs, and then... sadly, Manolito passed away in 16, so we decided to name it after him in 18.
Mm-hmm. And it's full of pictures of him, too.
Yeah, that's
and pictures of you guys in Cuba, right?
Right. It's so funny because they're all black and white, so you think they're stock photos because Cuba looks the same, but they're actually our photos. So if you keep looking, you're like, oh, yeah.
Because I'll see you guys in them. And I took friends there just like 2 weekends ago, and they loved it. And look, there's Conrad right there.
Yeah.
These are from when they went there, all these pictures, you know, scattered around, which is like, it just makes it even more cozy and more fun. And I think my friends who've gone... are regulars at the Tiki Tea in Los Angeles, which I think you're familiar with.
Yeah.
Tiny family owned.
Yeah.
And they were like, this would be our regular if we were here. Well, absolutely, because it has that vibe. It has that neighborhood, homespun, you know, it feels familiar, it feels welcoming. You know, vibe.
Yeah.
And then you walk out smelling like a Cubano no matter what.
Yeah, and it was really funny about Manolito's. In the first 2.5 years, maybe 3 years, the AC just was not.
Oh God!
It was not keeping up. And then people would come over and talk to me at Jewel, and they would say, "It's kind of genius that you're making it so we actually feel like we're in Cuba." And in the back of my mind, I'm like, "No, man." I love this. I'm not telling you the truth. I'm loving it and nodding.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm laughing my ass off. Sorry, can I say the A word?
Yeah, oh, you can totally swear. Totally
swear. I'm laughing my ass off, and I'm just like, you've got to be. And it's not 3 times. It's maybe 15, maybe 20.
Oh, my God.
That's like almost twice a month for 2 years. I mean, because obviously we had the one corona year and nothing happened. But it's like twice a month somebody actually comes in and just... And that's like they just can't wait to tell me how they thought that
how
was so cool.
Such an immersive experience.
That you're
experience.
Making a sweat. Yeah, and I'm just like, man, these guys are serious? And I mean, even Shannon, like,
girl, it's not like Disneyland. I
mean, and we all know, because it's like we had the same conversation with our coworkers, and they're just like, man, this is really a thing. And now I go back, and Conrad loves to hear it, Nick loved to hear it. It's like, man, this is, I'm not saying a word.
You know, chumming it with the bartenders. Did you check out music as well?
We checked out a lot of music.
I was going
to
say.
We had our own, when we would go Manalito, we would go to the beach, Tarera is the beach town. Manalito had his own restaurant. And when we went there, we walked to the beach and we had musicians with guitar and drums and just singing. It was nothing but Cuban song and dance, and it was so fantastic.
It's so great.
We went to Tropicana. That was amazing. But Santiago was my favorite music experience.
Well, Santiago has the big jazz festivals, at least they did.
And it's just, it was seen older for me. It seemed older. And the jazz music was just, I mean, that's also where we went to, we went and saw Company Segundo.
That sounds familiar.
One of the main people from Buena Vista Social Club. Mm-hmm. His grave was amazing. We went to that in Santiago. They have a huge bronze guitar standing up.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I think it's Company.
That sounds.
I think it's Company Segundo.
I'll have to look it up.
It's been a while.
That sounds familiar because I can't. Then, there's so many of them.
We went to his grave. We all made daiquiris. We was, aww, you know, but we also went to Casa Musica, which was insane for music in Cuba. But everywhere we went had music. Even at like Bodeguita de Medio, music there. The music that was in Florita. Rolly's wife actually was like one of the main singers, so it was always music. And with Julio, it's like everybody's dancing, you know. So we all, it's, as soon as we land, we open up a bottle of rum and we pour it out at the airport in little plastic cups and we take a shot. It's just like, as soon as we land in Cuba, it's go, and it's just straight nonstop.
I can relate. My family's from Colombia and from Cali specifically, and Cali is, they say it's the salsa capital of the world, you know, because they always have salsa festivals, everyone dances. That particular city is very much known for, Colombians like to party anyway. That area is very much known for their dancing, and my mom was actually a professional dancer. So anytime I've gone back to Cali, especially as an adult, as soon as you get off that plane, everyone's dancing and you're forced to dance. And I remember being there for New Year's Eve, and my cousin's father-in-law, who was mid-80s at the time, grabbed me. He's like, oh, you're gonna dance with me. And he was doing merengue, which is like 1,000 times faster.
Yeah, right.
And I'm all, I never took lessons. I just watched people and kind of have moves. He was going so fast, and I was trying to keep up with him, and everybody's just clapping and cheering, clapping. And when he was done with the song, he's like, you did it, you're good. And I'm all, how is my ankle not broken right now? How did I not fall
That's
over?
That's awesome.
It was so great, and I was laughing, and so they were like, there's hope for the American yet, you know?
Julio Cabrera will not let anybody not dance. And it's, we always got the music, and you know, all those trips, I went on 4 of those 7, I was really lucky. Since you brought up the music part, really, really, really lucky that I got to go with John LeMaire, because there was always that song, and he would always tip the band, say, Guantanamera, and then you could see like John LeMaire would like put his hands over his face, and that lit everybody up. There's only one John LeMayer.
Oh, I know that.
One John LeMayer.
Yes, yes.
One John LeMayer. Oh, we all lit up. It was beautiful.
Yes, so, I've been around when when that was sung to him.
Have to do it at every LeMayer tribute. Julio starts it off.
I still have this.
Yes.
On John LeMayer Day, you have to get out to Miami so that that can be performed. That's so wonderful.
I went a year ago.
That's so wonderful.
And we did the one John LeMayer on Yeah, it was amazing.
That's amazing. So you brought that back in Monolito. But when did you open up Jewel?
We opened up Jewel in 19. Almost the same month. So it's like the beginning of March, end of March. Mm-hmm. Beginning of March, 19 Jewel, end of March, 18 Monolito.
And are you an investor, an owner, just bar manager? What is your role in all these spots these days? Ownership is tough.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, partner at Manolito, and partner at Jewel.
Awesome.
And head bartender at Jewel.
That's awesome. That's quite a feat to do two in one.
Luckily Manolito's so small, and I'm just a small partner in Manolito. And in the end, it's gonna be where I work. Three ships at Jewel, one at Manolito, and then that'll be it for about 8 years before I retire. But
do you currently work at Manolito ever?
No,
if
I ever go to Manolito now, it's just to sit out front and have a cigar and say hello to people.
Yeah.
In the beginning, though, I was in a dish and just busing and letting them run because I could run the register, but.
Yeah.
I would just like, as soon as I could, if I could do that, it actually helps out the servers to actually talk to guests.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's basically what I did for Manolito.
So you're back there at Jewel then? Because I always see you back there doing your thing.
Jewel's a bigger endeavor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a full restaurant, so I'm there on days off like today.
It's a beautiful space. What was your concept? What did you want to do with that space?
Well, my partner, John, bought it. He wanted to turn it into a bed and breakfast, but the VCC wouldn't give him the hotel license, but he was able to have a restaurant and bar license, and so he walked over to me and Nick, and it was just like, you guys want to turn this into a restaurant? And then we're like, all right.
That was it.
There we go, and that's when I had to sadly talk to the Casbarians and I guess do my last thing with bar and restaurants, you know.
So with this one, you're running the show behind the bar, and again, you have classics and you have beautiful new ones. So you're still kind of
staying
with the program.
You know, that's my favorite quote from Count Arnaud from Arnaud's is like I'm reading about because I went crazy in depth with the history of Arnaud's, but. I loved reading the article about, they're like, well, how are you going to get people to come to Arnaud's and how are you going to be able to, you know, open this restaurant, you know, being like an immigrant yourself, you know? And he goes, well, I'm going to hold a delicate line between the old and the new. And then I'm going to make sure the chef and the service can do both. And that way everybody can be satisfied. And I was just like, oh, that was awesome. He said that way in 1917, he said that. You know, so keeping a delicate line between the old and the new 100 years ago. So it's like, I knew that's what I had to do. I mean, obviously, I had to be pigeonholed with the French 75, which I love. And I love turning it into a New Orleans cocktail. But I also wanted to make sure when guests came, they could get a classic. Because they want to come in and check that off. But then they're like, hey, can you make me something I've never had before?
Yeah.
So you had to be able to do both. And so that's what we do at Jewel. The classics are so easy for them because that's as soon as they get there, they're just like, oh, we're making these every day as well as our drinks that are seasonal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That quote seems to so perfectly fit your aesthetic, though. Just always.
Yeah.
Treasuring the old and making it relevant to the new.
Right.
Kind of thing, which I very much appreciate. I'm a vintage girl. All my furniture is old. It's either old or it's a good repro.
Right.
You know, so it matches.
Yeah, exactly.
My clothes, too. Although as I get older, I can't find the vintage clothes that fits me quite the way it used to when I was younger. But I still love beautiful vintage clothing because it was made well. It was made to last. You know, that sort of thing. So there's a reason with a lot of these old cocktails. There's a formula. That's why they stuck around for so long. Just classics. You know, I love that. And so it's interesting too because your music shows this too. Because when you came here, I asked before and I can't remember if we actually got it. Like, you are the. I you know all the juke joints. You keep following it. You're still investing in it. And right now, do you ever see, are there new ones? Is that possible? Can new juke joints exist, or is it just a,
you know,
is it a dying breed?
New juke joints do exist, and it's not a dying breed. What was really kind of cool were some musicians opening up their own places that are going to be juke joints. And then there's even one now in Jackson that started that has music on Friday nights. There's one in Oxford that has music on Sunday nights. And it is a dying breed. Originally, like, juke joints, honestly, were a place where the only black house in town had the money to have a record player and then have and a jukebox. And so that's where everybody came to listen to it, and that's why they called it a juke joint. That's why
Blue, it was the one gathering point.
Yeah, and Blue Front Cafe was the first one in Bentonia. But thankfully, it's not a thing where, you know, it's not appropriated. There's no appropriation of it into like a new bar that wants to call it a juke joint. You know, the hipsters have not done that yet. And honestly, I don't, I mean,
and I don't think they'll be able to.
No, they won't be able to.
No.
But I do love to see an old musician open up a cinder block house in the Delta. And then just because it's already has the aesthetic, because when you go into these juke joints, you're not going anything plush. You're in a cinder block square where things are hanging like from the ceiling, like they made themselves, you know what I mean? And it's just, it's such an amazing feel, and to hear like the wailing blues, it's really like, it's a breath of fresh air to know that it still exists. My favorite, I will tell you my favorite juke joint experience.
I was gonna say, I need to hear like a show that will never leave your memory.
There are two. I love all of them.
Well, I also want to know if you,
okay, my
there
favorite,
are new people
I shouldn't performing. I shouldn't even number. My favorite juke joint experience will always be Poe Monkey. Going to Poe Monkey's place, it's his house. It's a, he put two double wide trailers together and then cut the walls down and made it so everybody can hang out inside. And he has a party every single Thursday of his life. And it's a party. It's just like at your house that everybody goes to. It's a solid dirt road.
Does he live there? Well, yeah, he lives there.
Because like when I would go when it wasn't a Thursday.
How did you find out about this?
You have to go to like the blues headquarters in Clarksdale, and
wow.
Cathead Records has like everything
it's
out.
It's got the map out for you.
Yeah, but going there was special. Even when I went, when I couldn't go on a Thursday, I would still drive by Poe Monkey's, and he would be there, and he'd let me in. I'd be the only one in. And I got to tell him, it's like, you know that Garden and Gun article in 2005? When they had the best bars, we were in the same article. And he goes, you were in that article? It's just like, I'm so proud that you and I were in the same article. Because he, Poe Monkey, was the coolest person. When you went there and you watched how he just walked around to every table, I also gave him Cuban cigars. It was awesome.
What was he mentioned in there for? You were in there for best bar. What was he in there?
I was in there because I was a best bartender in a tuxedo and in 05.
Well, that's very specific.
But yeah, so I mean the juxtaposition of Garden and Gun's best bars of the South was amazing. Whoever put that together nailed it.
You want to be their best friend.
They just nailed it. They just nailed the entire South. You know, my picture was right next to Snake and Jake's.
To who?
Snake and Jake's.
Oh, really? That's awesome.
This is like, what is going on? It's like, here's me pouring a French 75 in a tuxedo.
All fancy tuxedo.
And then there's a really, really lovely photo of the morning when people are walking out of Snake and Jake's. You know what I mean? They killed it. And then they go to...
I thought it would be the dog having a drink at the bar Snake and Jake's.
Well, it's better than finding the opossum that made that drink, the possum drop that fell through the ceiling. I'm glad I wasn't there for that. That would have scared the hell out of me. But that article is my favorite article. I still have it.
That's awesome.
To be in an article with Poe Monkey, it's just like it would never happen again. But my favorite juke joint moments were meeting him, having cigars with him, drinking Old Fitzgerald with him. I have a photo. I'll send you a photo. Us smoking Cuban cigars with a bottle of Old Fitzgerald. Seeing Kip. Kip was 101 when I met him.
when you met
him? No, 90. He was 91.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was in Birmingham. And going to Kip's place was just like, I just waited and waited and waited for a Saturday night off. I waited 2 years to get to his place.
Wow.
Because I just don't have Saturday nights off. And when I did, I was out of town. Mm-hmm. You know? And so when I finally knew I was going to have this off, I went straight to Birmingham. I went straight to his place. I got a photo with him.
That was like Mecca, man, it sounds yeah. like. That's so great.
But going to the Blue Front Cafe and stopping in and Jimmy Jacome just letting us in and then having a Diet Coke with him, and then he wanted to have a Coors Light, so we were like, yeah, I'll have a Coors Light. If you're having a Coors Light, you know, yeah. it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you're not even open. You're letting us in here. And again, it's a cinder block, you know, house, you know, a hut. And he takes his guitar off the wall and he plays two songs for us.
So it was just...
That's Jimmy Jacome.
Just sitting there.
Yeah.
Said I love you, black woman, and I love your husband too. Well, not the reason I love him. Wanna go home.
This is the beginning of, we're not even at the first of the three Robert Johnson's graves. And this is supposed to be the cool part, was finding his graves. This was already, our trip was already made before we got to Clarkston. It was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, something like that, when I have experiences in that realm, I'm weeping inside. And then when I get outside, it's sort of like, just overcome,
yeah.
you know, with just being amazed that somehow life was able to deliver that experience. You know, just incredible. Well, where do you see music when you're here and you can't get out of town? Do you, or do you just wait till
you're
out of town?
Oh yeah, no.
I was gonna say, there's so much music here.
No, Sundays I see Second Lines. I go to a couple stops, or I go to one stop. I go to Second Lines. I go to almost every single Second Line during Second Line season.
Yeah.
But the brass band's going down the street. There's just nothing. It's amazing.
I know, was it WOZ has a page, right, with the Second Lines? And I don't know if it's just because it's Mardi Gras season. I'm staying over on Elysian Fields in Burgundy. Mm-hmm. So every Thursday, there's, I don't know if it's school, because there's a couple schools nearby, but every Thursday around 6, there's a marching band that comes down Royal, I think.
They're getting ready.
For about like 20 minutes, I could hear them coming, and then I'll go out and I can watch them as they cross over the street into the French Quarter and just keep on going. And I was like, I can't even imagine if that was where you practice. You know, marching bands are practicing on a football field, but you just practice in the street.
Right.
You just go.
It's funny. I never thought of that. Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming that's
doing. That's what they're doing, but I never thought of it the way you just said.
Yeah.
Usually you're in your own stadium or something. And I never...
This is New Orleans. No, it's the parade towns.
I was biking by today, and they were underneath the parking garage and at their school, and the drum line was nuts.
So yeah.
And I can always tell, it's like, oh, they're all getting ready for the parades, because they kill it. But I never thought of it the way you just thought of it. That was pretty brilliant.
Just, you know, just a different area, you know, practicing a different way. But where do you see your blues around here?
But other than that...
Because, I mean, we know jazz is everywhere in New Orleans, but what about blues?
I go... BJ's is my favorite. Just seeing live music. As soon as you start walking up to that wooden house and you hear the guitar and a horn wailing out of it, you're just like, it's... I feel like I'm still, like, back in my... in the 60s and 70s, in the 50s, you know what I mean? Doesn't matter who's playing. But BJ's, for me, I really love, because it's smaller, it's more intimate.
Yeah.
The crowd, it's like, you know, plastic cup, beer, you know. I do love a sweet jazz set at Snug Harbor, but honestly, Mahogany Hall is turning into my...
Your go-to.
Yeah, and also I love cigars, and so Dos Jefes.
Okay.
Dos Jefes Monday and Tuesday is really an amazing secret. It's just on a Tuesday, it's like I can be found there, because I do love cigars. It's still like it's like one of the last places grandfathered in.
Is it family run? Is that why?
Yeah. Well, also because it was cigar friendly before.
Okay.
It actually is the only one that's grandfathered in. Is Dos Jefes, because we were at French 25 Bar, but we just decided to go with the flow. Mm-hmm. But so Dos Jefes, Mahogany Hall in the Quarter is a gem. The ladies
still
are
here for a week.
The ladies used to run Fritzl's for 10 years, and everybody knows Fritzl's because it's like the only decent jazz place on Bourbon. Mm-hmm. But then they opened up their own spot 4 years ago.
Oh, okay.
It's
that's the connection.
Awesome.
Okay. And yeah, Fritzl's, I go past there all the time, but yeah.
And it's great, and I do love it. But they got Mahogany Hall is the same style, but it's mm-hmm. a little classed up. Mm-hmm. You know, not that it matters, but I mean, and the drinks are definitely better. They have a cocktail program. I'm not going to throw any kind of shade on it, any drinks on this interview. You get it? You know where you're going. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
But so music, yeah. BJ's, Vons on a Thursday, Bullets to Catch, Kermit, Kermit's mother-in-law. Any second line that's in the Treme, always go to mother-in-law. Wait for it to go by. It's just special.
Mother-in-law, I was thinking about going there on Tuesday night. So they have food too.
Yeah.
Maybe barbecues maybe on Tuesday or something. So I was like, that could be fun to check out.
Maple Leaf has George Porter on Tuesdays, and we don't know how much longer we'll be able to see that amazing show. So
we'll try to get that in there. It's incredible. Yeah. I mean, New Orleans offers opportunities that you just don't get anywhere else.
Yeah,
which is fantastic. So, all right. Well, I figure that's probably lots of info.
Sorry.
No, there's nothing to apologize for. It's incredible because blues, to me, I don't want to say it's an underserved genre, but I don't think people see it as innovating anymore, so they don't think about it as much, but that's not true because, like you were saying, it's blues is the foundation here in the United States. You know, it's everything was built off of that. More or less, you know?
Yeah.
So it's very important, and I know it's still around, but it's easy to go back and forth. If you, I'll end it here. So if you're home, or maybe you're out, what is your ideal drink and music that's playing? And is it live, or is it just sitting at home? I always like the pairings.
Ooh, the pairings.
So if it's a musical and drink pairing, or maybe it's a live show and drink pairing.
I do. I enjoy at Mahogany Hall. I'll have a Sazerac because I know they're going to make a Sazerac. I'm not going to go and ask for a Sazerac at BJ's. So whiskey, it's whiskey on the rocks at a bar in a plastic cup, like BJ's, Saturn bar, you know.
So then you go outside and swirl your cigar around, right?
Exactly. But, you know, when I go to Dos Jefes, you know, I can get a Sazerac. Mahogany Hall, I'll get a Sazerac. At home, it's WWOZ. Pouring a nice spirit from one of the shelves in my house. And if it's like preferred, you know, Dr. John, obviously, you know, one of my heroes, Dr. John or James Booker.
Yeah. Those
ain't
too shabby.
Danny Barker's, that was the surprise for me.
Danny Barker,
when I got here and I found out his history and his, like, how cool he was and saw the pictures of him. And then I was just like, the whole attire, just like, I'm going to start dressing like Danny Barker. And I even went to the Backstreet Culture Museum, and I asked for more photos of Danny Barker. And the lady said, you know, you kind of look like Danny Barker. And I was just like, you're going to get really mad, but I'm going to hug you right now. I couldn't believe she said that.
It was just meant to be. That's amazing. All right. Well, if you want people to find you on the social media, I don't know if you want to tell everybody that stuff, then I'll shut off the machine.
Okay. Social media is count_Hannah Instagram. There's Manolito Nola Instagram, Jewel Nola Instagram. I think it's just Chris Hannah on Facebook. I'm not on Facebook much anymore.
Yeah.
Mostly Instagram.
That's all the stuff.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Awesome.
I have learned so much today.
Very cool. That was a lot of fun.
And it makes me want a road trip too, which I know I can't do out here for a while, but one day.
I want to send you pics when I do, because
no, absolutely.
A couple months from now, I'll be in the road.
Excellent. I want to see it. I want to learn some more. All right. Well, thank you.
Such a night. You're such a night. Sweet confusion under the moonlight. Such a night, such a night, to steal away the time is right.
If you want to know the good places to eat and drink in New Orleans, just follow Chris on Instagram at count_Hannah, and you'll see all of the tasty treats he takes with him as he rides his bike around the city to sit and picnic and just, you know, be in the South. It's a whole different vibe down there. And you can follow Jewel of the South at Jewel Nola on Instagram as well. And you can listen to all kinds of amazing music that Chris was talking about during the course of this interview over on the playlist that we created for him on the Mo Herm Spotify page. Yeah, I think that's everything. I just loved even just listening to that, editing it. Sometimes editing these things can be a chore. It was not in this instance. It was so great. I didn't take anything out. That's why it was a long one this time. But I really hope you liked it. And thank you so much to Chris. Truly a gentleman. Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by The Mermaid, a cozy neighborhood bar with an aquatic flair in the Little Tokyo area of downtown LA. Open 7 days a week, featuring tropical cocktails and snacks, The Mermaid also has a daily happy hour from 5 to 8 p.m. Follow The Mermaid on Instagram at TheMermaidLA to hear about upcoming events and check them out at TheMermaidLA.com. Head to 428 East 2nd Street, Los Angeles, for a drink. Thank you for tuning in to our barroom chats on Music and Booze with Mo. For more info about today's guest, or if you want to connect with me, check out my Facebook page, Mo Herms. Please subscribe to the podcast and feel free to tell all your friends about it. While you're there, give the show a rating and a review. It really helps to get the word out. If you want to hear the playlists our guests have curated, search She Be Mo on Spotify, S-H-E-B-M-O. Find pictures of the interviewees and the cool stuff they create on the Music and Booze with Mo Instagram account. Lower your expectations and join us at the bar. Till next time, cheers.